are listening to a podcast from The National.
Well, it took some time, but we're finally there. Almost. Sort of. Although Manchester United and Arsenal, at the time of recording at least, are yet to officially ratify the transfers of Alexis Sanchez and Henrik Mkhitaryan, the Chilean forward has been pictured on social media at Old Trafford in full United regalia, wearing the club's famous number 7 shirt. Manchester City banished the memory of defeat to Liverpool with victory over Newcastle to maintain their 12-point lead at the top of the Premier League. Spurs were foiled in their efforts to snare 3 points against Southampton in a game that won't live too long in the memory. Marco Silva, a wanted man by Everton 2 months ago, is now no longer wanted by Watford. The Portuguese was sacked at the weekend following a defeat to Leicester. He's replaced by the former Malaga manager, Xavi Garcia. Will the new man have the same immediate impact as Paul Lambert? The new Stoke manager endeared himself at the Potteries by overseeing a 2-0 win over Huddersfield in his first game in charge. I'm your host, Steve Luckins. I'm joined in the studio today by our sports editor, Graham Cagle. Graham, welcome, my friend.
Cheers, Steve. Thanks for having us.
How's it going, mate?
Not too bad, not too bad. I'll try and talk a little bit so you can get your breath back after that intro.
I know. Right, we're good, we're good. Okay, I think there's only one place to start. It is inevitable. It's only a matter of time before it is made official. The Alexis Sanchez transfer. The long wait looks to finally be over. Like I said, pictures of him in Manchester United kit wearing the number 7 shirt, a number synonymous with great United players down the years, from George Best to Brian Robson, Eric Cantona, David Beckham, and more recently Cristiano Ronaldo. It's all over social media. The formalities of a medical and personal terms have been agreed from what is being reported. And some of those reports are saying Sanchez has signed a mind-boggling £400,000 a week. Henrik Mkhitaryan, we assume, is in a similar situation. Probably not on quite as much money, but about to have the deal officially ratified by Arsenal. What do you make of this bit of transfer business, Gray? Who comes out the winner in this?
I think you'd have to call it a score draw, quite frankly, because I think United have got the player that could kick them on, maybe not this season, but really give City a tough time for the title next season. Well, Arsenal are going to get a lot of money for a player that they could have lost for free in the summer anyway, and have got someone with great potential in Mkhitaryan who, for whatever reason, after a promising start to the season at United, has gone off the rails. But I think United probably do just shade it if I had to pick a winner, because I kind of see from the names you mentioned earlier a little bit of similarity to Cantona and that Sanchez, great player, a little bit of a difficult personality, it seems, behind the scenes at Arsenal. But United, they seem quite close at the moment to having a great side, but they just need that little bit of a difference maker up front, someone who does something a bit unpredictable.
You see him as the missing piece?
Possibly. I think he could be, potentially. They've had a lot of false dawns recently, but I definitely think he could be.
I'm really looking forward to seeing him and Paul Pogba together. Like, I think Pogba is so underrated. I think if you take into account the number of games he's missed this season, and yet his assist stats and everything else, I really think them as a combo are really going to make United kick on. They're too far behind City now, like you say, for it to make a difference. But certainly next season, you can see them starting on more of a level playing field.
Oh, absolutely. If they're, in a way, they're not going to admit this, but they're probably going to treat these next 5-6 months as like almost practice for next season, like an early pre-season. Get Sanchez bedded in, see how he works alongside Lukaku, Rashford, Martial, see what works, what doesn't. Because Jose said one of the reasons they wanted him now is he wants more competition for his forward places. He wants options. Like, if you remember the great Ferguson side of the late 90s, he had 4 strikers. If Colin York wasn't firing,
Sheringham and Solskjaer came in.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, and it's kind of a cliche to say the strength of a bench does make a difference. And obviously, Sanchez isn't going to be starting on the bench most of the time, but as a consequence of him being there, someone's going to be on the bench who's going to be quite decent. So I think it's going to be interesting how they finish the season. I think they've got a decent chance in the FA Cup if they can really sort of push on, because you've got a feeling like City, it already feels like City, like the sheer amount of games, the fact they're playing again on Tuesday night against Bristol City, sometimes success can wear you out in a way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, definitely. From an Arsenal perspective, Gray, I've just read in one UK newspaper, quotes attributed to Arsene Wenger, who said he can't understand why any player would want to leave Arsenal. Well, where has he been for the past 5 months? No, probably longer than that, actually. Alex Oxlade Chamberlain left for Liverpool. Sanchez has now left for United. Mesut Ozil looks very unlikely to commit his future to North London. Is Wenger deluded, or do you think he genuinely believes they are still a title-chasing team? They are coming off a very impressive performance at the weekend against Crystal Palace, where Nacho Monreal looks like the natural successor to Alexis Sanchez, obviously. But, yeah, what's he talking about?
I think delusion is possibly the word. Like, that's been the sort of the rumour that's gone around and why he stayed on, because he's been convinced that Arsenal are that close to becoming a title-winning force like he had in the early 2000s. That's why he won't let go, because he's had about two or three numerous opportunities to step aside at a winning moment, i.e. all the FA Cup finals that they've won recently. It's a very frustrating one, because it goes even further. Robin van Persie was Mr. Arsenal, really, for many years. He was like the guy you really fought over, the guy, and the fact that he sacked them off to go to Manchester United to get his the title win off his bucket list kind of summed it up, really, sort of, in many ways. And the fact it's going on now, and like, you know, I might have given Sanchez a bit of a hard time earlier, sort of, like, because Sanchez isn't an outstanding player, and you can't blame him for being frustrated at the fact, like, the key issues in Arsenal's side were still not being addressed. The defence, the fact the midfield still, like,
the dominant centre midfielder. How many transfer windows have come and gone, and Wenger hasn't gone out and addressed that position?
Because my one fear is that Mkhitaryan is more of what they've got already. He's going to be like, on his day, he's going to have a couple of great matches where he's going to be unplayable, probably link up really well with Lacazette and Giroud and Co, and it's going to be like brilliant. But then, I hate to say it, but on a Tuesday night at Stoke, when they're 1-0 down and the ball's not rolling for him, is Mkhitaryan the guy who's going to roll up his sleeves and inspire the comeback and get him the hard-earned point? Because at the moment, the fact they've had to go back to Jack Wilshere, who, yeah, he's had so many injury troubles and such, but the fact they've had to go back to a guy who, this time last season, was struggling to get in Bournemouth's team.
Yeah.
If I was an Arsenal fan, it wouldn't be really fulfilling me with optimism right now. They've done well to get the money, but what they do for the rest of this transfer window is going to be very telling, because at the moment, they've got to win the Europa League, quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, and in fairness to Wenger, he has said that their activity in the transfer market doesn't end with Mkhitaryan. Obviously, Theo Walcott has gone, Coquelin has joined Valencia. So, and there is still time. You can imagine. But that's, for me, that's always been his problem position. He has never replaced Gilberto Silva, and you know, that carried on the tradition of Vieira and Petit. That's always been his problem position. Unless he goes out and he makes that midfield general signing, you know, Cazorla, I almost feel like we're writing off his career. I don't think we're ever going to see him again, and it's a shame. But he's not that type of player either. No. Wenger needs to go out and he needs to sign that midfield enforcer.
Because the irony is, he might actually be really close to him, because with all the uncertainty, and we're going to talk about in a bit about Watford, is Doucouré's been one of the players of the season, I think, in terms of, like, you think of how average Watford's form has been late. He's been outstanding. He's the kind of player they need.
Yep.
And they basically, the training grounds are right next to each other. So if Wenger's not aware of him, that's frightening.
Well, he's not aware of why players want to leave Arsenal, so he may well be, mate.
True.
Okay, well, let's get back to United then. With all the brouhaha over the Sanchez transfer, they actually recorded a 1-0 win at Burnley at the weekend, a fifth consecutive shutout led by Phil Jones, who I personally feel is fast becoming the best centre-back in the country. But United got a fair bit of flack for only winning 1-0. I'm doing that in inverted commas for all our listeners who can't see. But winning at Turf Moor, no matter how it comes about, is an achievement these days.
Oh, no, absolutely. I think only Man City have really sort of put a few past them this season. Liverpool burgled the last-minute winner over there. It's like, that's the great thing about Sean Dyche's side. Like, they don't really raise their game against anyone. They're just tough to beat no matter who you play. If you get 3 points off Burnley this season, you've done well, because they're so well set up. There's no sort of frills or excitement about them, but they do what they do really well. And as you said, sort of, like, Phil Jones has done an excellent job at the back, and it almost feels like it's becoming a Mourinho side. Like, at the very least, they're going to draw. They're not conceding. They've got obviously a brilliant keeper in De Gea, but he's now got a defence in front of him, so he's having to make less superlative performances to get through it. So I thought, I agree with you, I thought it was a cracking result.
Yeah, and I thought Anthony Martial's goal was superb. The way he gave the keeper the eyes, looking like he was going to bend it round the back post, went for the near post. I thought that was absolutely superb. It was one of my favourite goals of the weekend. That win narrowed the gap on Manchester City, albeit briefly, to 9 points. It was then business as usual, extended to 12 points. As we said, they banished the memory of defeat to Liverpool by beating Newcastle 3-1. Sergio Aguero scored his 11th hat-trick in City colours, although I'm still a bit dubious about the first one, but I guess it's hard to take a goal away from someone like that. City, as per usual, had the bulk of possession. One stat I found, in the first half hour, Newcastle completed just 33 passes, or three per man, which says it all. But in fairness to them, they were in the game at 2-1. They got a little bit more adventurous, and inevitably that, you know, when City have more space to exploit, that can be a team's undoing. But yeah, it's as you were for Manchester City after the blip against Liverpool.
I think if you had to pick someone to play right now as sort of your bounce back game, Newcastle at home probably would have been that side. But all the uncertainty off the field as well going on for them.
Sure. And Sergio Aguero would have picked them as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think is that 14 goals he scored against them now?
Yeah, I think something like that. And they, as you said, it was a case of how many they were going to score. It feels like they've eased off a little bit from scoring the 5, 6, and 7s they were racking up quite regularly in October, November, which is perhaps inevitable because of the sheer bulk of games they've got at the moment. But it was important that they bounced back immediately, because you always feel like if they drop suddenly a couple of, if they draw one game and suddenly the gap gets narrowed to 10 or to 8, suddenly Manchester United might suddenly show a little bit more interest in this. Because at the moment, the key thing for United is, I think the United's next game is Tottenham away, which is a huge game.
Yeah.
Because I think City are at home to West Brom, so it'll be very unlikely City don't get 3 points out of that. So United, if United have got any hope, it's an unlikely hope, but if they're going to stay in this,
yeah,
they've got to be perfect for a little while. And they've got the defence to do it, but it's, pressure can do funny things. And so we're coming up to the Champions League period when City are going to be playing more double weeks and such. And so are United. But United have got the little catalyst now of Sanchez coming in.
Yeah, and hijacked City's deal for him, really.
Yeah, because City are trying to put a brave face on it, which is understandable. And sort of, basically, from Pep's point of view, he got the ideal response from Sergio, that's why I didn't need him.
Yeah,
sort of,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Scoring a hat-trick there, and the fact that Jesus is coming back soon as well.
It does sound ridiculous, doesn't it, to think that Aguero's place might have been under threat,
yeah,
from Sanchez. It's ridiculous.
And speaking of the neutral, I am kind of quite pleased, like, cause, mainly because of how frightening that would have been, having Sanchez in that lineup as well. Like, it would have been something quite similar to almost what Barcelona had when they had Neymar, Suarez and Messi together, sort, yeah, of like, if you think City are frightening already, what they could have had. So the fact it sort of varies it up a little bit, I think, is good for the league as a whole.
And also, I had him in my fantasy football team, so very pleased
there
with that.
There you go.
Well, we have another guest on this week's show. Joining us on the line now from Bolton in England is our Premier League correspondent, Richard Jolly. Richard, how are you, mate?
Good, thanks, Steve. You?
Yeah, not too bad at all, mate. Thank you. Richard, I want to talk to you about the Southampton-Tottenham game. I'm hoping that you can brighten up what was otherwise a very dull game for us. Now, just watching the game, Richard, Southampton started the game very well. They got in behind the Spurs defence on a number of occasions. They seem to specialise in non-scoring strikers at the moment, don't they? But they did take a lead rather fortuitously, I would say, through Davinson Sanchez. Harry Kane got the equaliser, 99 Premier League goals for him now. And there were chances for both teams after that, but neither can make it count. Do you feel like the match encapsulated the seasons for both teams? Spurs failing to put away yet another team in the lower half of the table, and Southampton just failing to capitalise on goal-scoring opportunities?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's an element of that for both. I felt, whilst it wasn't actually an out-and-out bad result for either team, I didn't think it was a particularly satisfactory one. I mean, to talk about Spurs first, I was just looking at their results. And the last two teams they've dropped points against were West Ham and Southampton. Then you go back to early on in the season and the draws with Burnley and Swansea. Well, OK, Burnley are in the top half of the table, but you would still expect Tottenham to beat Burnley at home. And I think it's just over the season as a whole, despite Harry Kane's extraordinary goal-scoring form, Tottenham haven't been quite as ruthless as they were last season. They haven't been quite as good at putting teams away. And I think that's why they will end up with a lower points total and almost certainly a lower position. Spurs, I thought, definitely missed Christian Eriksen. And yesterday was a day when they needed Dele Alli to play well, because Son's been terrific recently, but he had a bit of an off day. Harry Kane still scored a goal, and that wasn't enough, and they could have done with a bit more from Dele Alli. In terms of Southampton, yeah, on the face of it, decent point at home against a team who are going well in the Champions League and could finish in the top four again. But the reality is with Southampton is they draw a lot of games and they win very, very few. And that's not actually a coincidence when you get to this stage of the season. I mean, I wrote before the game that Southampton haven't really beaten a competent 11-man team in the Premier League all season, which is a pretty damning indictment of a team that's finished in the top eight for 4 years in a row. And a team that does have some good players. And we saw yesterday, Dusan Tadic, I thought, started the game very well. James Ward-Prowse had a good game. Ryan Bertrand put in the cross that led to Davinson Sanchez's own goal. But you're right to flag up the striking issue. It has been a real problem. Gabbiadini began brightly yesterday, didn't really finish off that brightly, and of course didn't score a goal. I don't think Gabbiadini would have started had Shane Long not been ill, and Shane Long's a player with one goal in 11 months. And to me, with Southampton, they haven't really been good enough in either box. If you look at them, if you look at one of their games as maybe a one-off and you hadn't seen a league table, I don't think you'd necessarily say they're a team in the bottom three. But the cumulative evidence of 23, 24 games is that they don't win enough games, they don't score enough goals, they're not quite ruthless enough. And even though you wouldn't perhaps expect them to beat Tottenham, they're getting to a stage where they're going to have to start to win some games that maybe you wouldn't tip them to, whether it's against a top team, whether it's an away game, somewhere they've got to, those draws are not enough when you see teams like Stoke winning on Saturday and going above Southampton and putting them into the bottom three.
Now, it was a bit of an ugly game, Richard. There was quite a lot of fouls, and I guess the main culprit, as it were, would probably, from a Southampton perspective, be Moussa Dembele. He was seemingly on a one-man mission to go through and barrel through the entire Southampton team. Do you think he was lucky to leave the pitch as a substitute rather than being sent for an early bath by the referee?
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, certainly he could have been booked earlier. There's no doubt about that. I think he had quite a lenient referee and he maybe took advantage of that. I think he got booked for his sixth foul, and sometimes you see people getting booked for persistent fouling when they've committed about three fouls. But I think what might have been the case was that had he been booked earlier and had he seemed to be on a tightrope a bit earlier, then maybe Pochettino would have just substituted him earlier. I mean, Tottenham, they do have other central midfielders available at the time, and Victor Wanyama came off the bench. So it would have been very possible for them just to take Dembele off a bit earlier. And instead, maybe because the referee was a bit lenient, you ended up with that scrappy second half of quite a few players fouling each other, and then belatedly the yellow cards were coming out.
Following Marco Silva's sacking at the weekend by Watford, that is now eight Premier League managers who have lost their jobs this season. Up next for Southampton is Brighton, a very big South Coast derby. Now, Mauricio Pellegrino, would you say that's a game that Southampton have to win, or maybe at the very least avoid defeat? Is his position becoming untenable?
I think from the perspective of the season and from the way things have been going for them, it's a game they have to win because they haven't won any of their last 11 Premier League games. Whether he personally has to win it, I don't know. But what I would say about that is, you're right, eight managers have gone. All of those eight managers have gone from the bottom 14 clubs. So that's more than 50%. The Marco Silva case is interesting because, from what I heard, Southampton did have an interest in Marco Silva in the summer. But by the time Southampton sacked Claude Puel, Marco Silva had already been appointed by Watford, which was one of the reasons why it actually seemed quite a coup for Watford to get him at the time, was because Southampton and I think Crystal Palace had both been interested. I mean, I don't know if Pellegrino is on the brink. I think Southampton actually haven't sacked that many managers in recent years. They don't tend to be that trigger happy. Even with Puel, there was some surprise as to how long it took in the summer. But the further it goes on into the season and the longer they go without a win, the greater the problems can become. I don't think relationships, from what I've heard, I don't think they've broken down there completely, but the reality is it's just that they're not winning games. And that, to me, is why they have to beat Brighton, as well also just for the fact that Brighton are a relegation rival, and Southampton don't really beat relegation rivals very often. If they can do that, they put Brighton deeper into trouble.
And as you said there, Richard, Southampton, from what you can gather, held a strong interest in Silva. All of a sudden, the stars may have aligned then, in terms of maybe wanting to get the man they had earmarked originally. So I guess that could, in a sense, put some extra pressure on Pellegrino for the Brighton game.
Yeah, it definitely could. I think there's an interesting case with Silva because clearly he's a very, very ambitious manager. Unfortunately for him, he didn't hide that ambition well enough. I do wonder if his reputation will be tainted to some degree from clubs thinking that Marco Silva would just see them as a stepping stone. But equally, if Southampton think they're in real danger of relegation and think Marco Silva is the best man to get them out of it, they can afford to take a short-term punt on him, saying, look, if you get us out of trouble, we will let you go in the summer if you get a bigger job. And so I do think it does put more pressure on Pellegrino, because with every time a club sacks a manager, there's always the question of who can you get next. And in the case of Stoke, they sacked Mark Hughes without having a successor lined up. Everton sacked Ronald Koeman without having a successor lined up. If Southampton think there is a successor there available, ready and willing to replace Pellegrino, it actually makes it a lot easier to get rid of Pellegrino.
Right, OK. Very cut and thrust, but that is the way the Premier League works. Richard, thank you very much for joining us this week, mate. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Cheers, Steve. No problem.
Just carrying on there from what Richard was talking about there, Graham. Of course, it's FA Cup action this weekend, and the bizarre scenario of Watford versus Southampton. Is there a scenario where Silva could be in the Southampton dugout to face the team that has just sacked him?
Quite possibly. As Richard said, Silva was very popular in the summer. A lot of teams wanted him, including, obviously, Watford got him, but Palace were interested as well as Southampton. Given how they're struggling under Pellegrino, it's not behind the realms of possibility it could happen, which it would be remarkable. I'm pretty sure I don't think that's ever happened where a guy's being fired and then plays his up against his old team the following week. It would be remarkable scenes.
Yeah, I can't think of one. But just looking a little deeper into the Silva situation, I mean, we're 5 months into the campaign now. Already 8 managers have lost their jobs. You think 6 lost their jobs in the entirety of last season. They lost 2-0 to Leicester at the weekend. And Watford put out some pretty strong statements with regards to Everton and the unwanted approach, as they put it, in Silva when Ronald Koeman was dismissed in November. And I think if you look at the form table, Gray, it doesn't make for good reading, does it? 5 points from the past 11 games, or the last 33 on offer, minus 12 goal difference. You know, Watford are still 10th in the table, pretty respectable, but they're only 4 points above relegation. You can understand why the Pozzo family looked at this situation and saw a pretty desperate situation developing.
Oh, absolutely. I think, unquestionably, if this had carried on the way it was going, they would probably, at best, be deep in a relegation fight by the end of the season, but more likely would have been relegated, because 5 points from 11 games is relegation form, and it probably goes on a little bit longer. Funnily enough, since the Arsenal game, I think it's only 11 points from 16 games.
And you've got a theory, haven't you, that all the late goals they were scoring in that fantastic run maybe masked the deficiencies in the team?
Well, the one strange element was early in the season, there were some very professional away wins where they were very disciplined. They won 2-0 at Bournemouth, they won 2-0 at Southampton. Those were probably the most impressive displays of the season, because there was lots of chaotic performances. Like, as you said, they scored a late winner at Swansea, they got the late winner against Arsenal in the game where Deeney made some rather ill-advised comments to Arsenal afterwards about lacking cojones and such like that. But
the late equaliser against West Brom.
Yeah, Richarlison's header in the stoppage time. As in hindsight, maybe that did kind of flatter where Watford were, because the defence has not been great all season. All teams, every time they've come up against anyone who's been half decent or had a bit of an about them, they've scored, like, I think City have beaten them 9-1 on aggregate. United put 4 past them. Chelsea put four past them. There's been quite a few routes, which hints at lack of discipline sort of in the side or a little bit of sort of tactical nous. But I think, as you mentioned, it does go back to the Everton approach, because it was quite apparent immediately by the fact that Silva didn't play it down himself that he was up for it.
Yeah.
Which, in hindsight, I think he made a mistake himself. And it's easy to say from the Watford point of view, but Everton, the way the Premier League works now, realistically, unless there's a freak season, Everton's glass window is 7th or 8th. Yeah, they've got a bit of money to spend on the new owner, but so have a lot of clubs. That's no guarantee.
Yeah. And as it's been no guarantee. Yeah. They spent £150 million in the summer.
Yeah, and as we've seen with Sam Allardyce, changing the manager is no guarantee of sort of changing it around. That's a real tough job.
Because they're 2 points above Watford?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like because the mid-table is very, very tight, because I know there's a lot of eyebrows raised about Watford being 10th and, well, what do you expect? But when you look deeper at it, sort of, it's not just the 5 points from 11 games, because a lot of teams can have that in the Premier League if you have a tough run of games. But Watford have been losing to a lot of sides around them. Watford have actually effectively dragged themselves back into the relegation zone, because they've actually done quite well against some of the tougher games. But in December, I think they managed to lose to Crystal Palace, Huddersfield, Brighton. The Swansea City thing was the one that I think that really broke people. They were 1-0 up with 3 minutes to go and managed to concede twice. And
yeah.
That's really sort of, I think, what's really hurt them. And the fact that it's been quite obvious that Silva's either got no answers or not really being interested. His body language in the dugout screams of a guy who didn't want to be there. It's a real shame, sort of. But going back to what I was originally trying to say in terms of, if he'd kept his head down, the way the season's worked out right now, he'd have had a cracking chance with the momentum Watford had. If he just kept his head down, said, no thanks, but no thanks, I've just started a job at Watford, said no to Everton, maybe go, who knows what happens in summer. But he had a great chance of getting Watford 8th or 9th, the way this table was looking. And that would be Watford's best result in 31, 32 years in terms of finishes in the league, which is a great, great feather in the cap, especially after, yeah, he's seen as he got a hole relegated, but he also almost kept him up. And when Harris did, he's going to walk into another job quite quickly. I think this will be seen as a blip. Like, there was reports that at the start of the season, he wasn't happy about some of the players at Watford released out on loan or sort of didn't keep. Like, he didn't have as much to say as I think he thought he did. So I think maybe that might have been why he was quite keen on getting to Everton and maybe getting out of there. But I don't think he's covered himself in a blaze of glory in how he's handled this.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's interesting, isn't it? Like you say, he came with, despite being relegated with Hull, came with a very, very enhanced reputation. Obviously, Watford's fantastic start to the season only added to that, which obviously led to the interest from Everton. Is there a danger now, though, that Silva is seen as only seeing other clubs as a stepping stone? I mean, he's ambitious. He never stays long in jobs. And as you say, it became very interest once Everton, let it be known they were interested, that he was more than interested. And I also think Watford aren't blameless in this. I think Watford operate very successfully, as it turns out, on short-termism. You know, they have short-term objectives with their managers, with their players. There's never a long cycle, and it's working for them. It almost goes against the grain of every other Premier League club. But in a sense, this was probably always going to be the inevitable outcome for Silva and Watford. Probably not this early, probably not 5 months, but this is probably how it would have always ended for them.
Oh, no, completely. In the summer, Scott Duxbury, the chief executive here in the interview, where he kind of said that the manager's kind of role wasn't seen as that important as much as the model that Watford work under. And I kind of said, like, we expect the manager kind of sort of to be changeable every 2 years, which, spoiler alert, probably means that, you know, you shouldn't be thinking about building that big property in Hertfordshire or building that extension, sort of, if your manager sort of in your 1 year in. Because there's been a lot made of the fact that under the Pozzos, I think Watford have had 8 managers in a very short space of time. Not all of them have been fired. But obviously, since being in the Premier League, they moved Kike Sanchez-Flores on because I think they could see there was a element of deterioration. Teams had worked Watford out a little bit. They had a cracking first half to that season under Kike. The Mazzarri season, the irony is, and I only spotted this point on Twitter earlier, is like the Mazzarri season is seen by a lot of Watford fans as an absolute disaster. Like, it really just stayed up by the skin of our teeth, even though they stayed up quite comfortably.
Yeah.
But the irony is, they've actually got more points under Mazzarri at this time of the season than they actually did under Silva.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's an interesting, when you actually put the whole context of it. But I think this season, I don't want to use the phrase loosely, but mediocrity outside the top six this season. It's very much of a muchness. You've got Burnley, and if you win a couple of games, you go miles clear. And like,
well, look at Leicester.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All you have to do is get a bit of momentum, and you've kind of got that now. But as you said, like Watford the 10th, but as far as most Watford fans are looking, everyone's looking back, not up.
They're,
right,
they're in a relegation dogfight.
Well, they're next. They've got Southampton the FA Cup on Saturday, but then the next game at home to away at Stoke City on the following week is absolutely huge for them, because obviously they're up against another side with a new manager as well. But given Watford's sort of past ability for losing to virtually every other single possible relegation rival, they've got Chelsea after that, and I think they've got West Ham away coming up as well soon. This is a really big period for them, and the new guy's going to have to hit the ground running.
Well, speaking of the new guy, we've been talking about Watford for 10 minutes and not even mentioned him. Xavi Gracia, I hope I'm saying that right, the 10th manager the Pozzo family have hired since 2012. What can you tell us about him, Gray? Do you think Watford fans will be receptive to him?
I think most Watford fans, if they've been completely honest, hadn't heard of him until last night, and sort of having to put him into sort of Wikipedia and search engines.
Yeah,
and
because
stuff.
The name doesn't look right, does it? It should be Garcia.
No,
but
completely. So I think there's been a lot of sort of urgent scrambling around and trying to get an update on sort of mid-table Primera Liga form. But everything about him sounds like he kind of fits the positive mould. He's sort of tactically aware, quite astute. And the advantage of Mazzarri, which one of the problems he had was he speaks reasonable English. I think he's still learning more, but generally speaking, he's pretty highly regarded in Spain. Our Spanish football correspondent, Andy Mitten, said he's very impressed with the job he did at Malaga and thinks he'll slot in quite quickly. Well, for the challenges, obviously, it's always difficult when you're coming in mid-season. But he's obviously still got the transfer window, and the Pozzos have made it clear that money will be available for recruitments. It'll be interesting to see who goes in and goes out, because obviously Watford have relied heavily on Richarlison in the first half of the season, and it's been quite clear that he was very close to Silva. And he's kind of been the difference maker. He was something that Mazzarri lacked last season, the kind of difference maker in games. And that's why Watford have really improved the season. And I think that's going to be Gracia's first job, is to try and get him on board, or at least say, look, give me the rest of the season. Don't jump board, you know, don't down tools, whatever you do.
Yeah,
we really need to kind of kick on here. And because the irony is, they only really need three wins would sort of get them pretty close to sort of a comfort level.
Probably keep them up.
Yeah, because I've got a feeling it's going to be a very low total this season.
Yeah, I do.
But yeah, so it's going to be an interesting, well, particularly if Silva rocks up at Southampton.
Okay, so let's... obviously, Watford fans will be hoping that Gracia has the desired impact that another new manager had this weekend. Paul Lambert, who oversaw a 2-0 win over Huddersfield in his first game in charge of Stoke. But more importantly, I think, Gray, is that Stoke kept a clean sheet. Because if you look at their squad, I don't think there's tons of goals in that team. And I think that's true for the 10 or 11 clubs that... This sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? 10 or 11 clubs that are in a relegation battle at the moment. So keeping goals out is absolutely paramount to Stoke's hopes of survival, and largely what they've based most of their success on in the Premier League.
Oh, no, completely. Like, when you think of Stoke's MVP, you don't think of Peter Crouch, you think of Ryan Shawcross.
Absolutely.
Who, yep. I saw him in October when Stoke won at Watford, and he was absolutely colossal that day. And it's kind of surprising, because you think they've got Zouma from Chelsea, yep. And so they've still got some good personnel there, but whether it was just a bit stale under Chelsea, but from what I remember of Paul Lambert's rather soggy reign at Aston Villa was the fact like Villa were reasonably solid defensively and kind of regressed as they went on. But
yeah, we looked at the stats of the points he picked up at Villa over a 38-game season, and it was 1.3 points per game. Now, under Mark Hughes this season, 22 games under at Stoke, 20 points, that's 0.91 points per game. And Paul Lambert, after one game, obviously has 3 points, so that's a much better average already. But, it's the problem with Stoke is they were probably went the other way towards Watford, where Watford didn't perhaps give Silva any time to turn it around. Stoke arguably gave Hughes too long in a failing job. But full credit to Paul Lambert. I mean, you can't ask for more, can you? A new manager coming in getting these big players. Like, you know, I think Joe Allen is a really big player for them, really good player. Getting him on the score sheet. So it can only be onwards and upwards. Obviously, with the Southampton result, they dropped back into the bottom three, so Stoke are out. But like you said, that doesn't mean anything when Watford are only 4 points clear of relegation. Another team who are in real trouble, though, Everton. Now, they have regressed back to what they were under Koeman, I think, in terms of performances, definitely results. Two new signings in Theo Walcott and Cenk Tosun. The former making an impact off the bench with an assist for one of Everton's goals against West Brom. And a point against West Brom in itself isn't necessarily a terrible result, but the news that James McCarthy faces a lengthy spell out with a horrific broken leg, done in the line of duty very much, stopping Solomon Rondon a clear goal-scoring opportunity. I mean, it was a double whammy for Everton in that regard, that, you know, A, that he had to leave the field, and B, that he's not going to be seen again this season. Probably won't even be ready for the start of next season.
Well, absolutely. It's horrible to see. And Rondon's reaction told the story to that.
Yeah.
Like, the poor lad was absolutely devastated by it. And, yeah, it sort of kind of does put things a little bit into perspective when those kind of incidents happen. But as you said, I've got a feeling, if you look at Everton's early run of games they had, that did sort of paper over the cracks. And Allardyce, if you look at his history, has got a great record of sort of coming in, giving everyone a bit of a lift. But it is papering over the cracks, I think, as you said. Then it's a lack of goals. It's like, it's difficult to see where they're coming from in that side, sort of, because they brought Wayne Rooney in the summer, who was, in his own words, he thinks he's becoming more of a midfielder than a striker.
Yep.
So that was never going to work. And so obviously they've tried to bring in a couple more sort of forward-leaning players, but Walcott is yet to actually ever convince fully out. There's a reason Arsenal sold him, because he didn't convince as a forward. Every time they tried to play him in that role,
yeah,
it didn't ever work out. And obviously it's early days on Tosun on that, so how that's going
to
work.
It's almost like we're still waiting after 10 years for Theo Walcott to arrive, aren't we? He's the perennial man-child.
Oh, well, he had that big breakout moment in Croatia in September 2008, and we thought, bingo, here we go.
Yeah, the hat-trick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, as you said, it's just, there's little cameo appearances, like, I seem to remember there was a Premier League game when he absolutely torched Newcastle and he scored, I think, three or four goals.
And, yeah.
And you're thinking, wow, absolutely unplayable. But there's a reason Arsenal haven't won the title since 2004, because they didn't happen enough. And sort of like, in fairness, Walcott, with his consistent performance, is a mid-table player, and that's where he's gone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also with McCarthy's injury, it was interesting listening to Leon Osman, a former Everton midfielder, obviously. And he was asked where he traces Everton's problems with, because obviously they spent massive money in the summer. And obviously there's a big Romelu Lukaku-shaped hole missing at the top of their attack. But they knew Lukaku was going last January. They didn't plan properly for that. But for him, that wasn't, well, it wasn't the only reason. He said what Everton have done over the last few years is kind of stockpile the same type of midfielder. James McCarthy, Morgan Schneiderlin, Idris Gueye, these destroyers of midfielders. There's not enough creativity in there. So when you took Lukaku out of there, that focal point of the attack, you know, these kind of guys who get the ball forward to him, that's now missing, and there's not enough creativity either side of that to fill the void. So, I mean, Everton definitely need to add to that squad. I think I agree with you. I think Walcott is probably the perfect type of player for Everton. I think if they play him up the middle, he'll be the main man. But I do think they lack width in that team. Goals as well, but definitely width as well.
Because that's the irony, like, as you said there, like Walcott wants to play in the middle. But in a way, for that Everton side, width is, he's very, very quick. Obviously, he's still got that. The wing probably would be the better position for him, but they haven't got anyone in the middle yet sustained to sort of give him that option. So I think they've got enough quality. It's obviously difficult to say this. I think they've got more than enough to stay up, but whoever takes over long haul, because obviously Sam, I don't think Sam's there that long term.
Well, he signed an 18-month deal, didn't he? But I guess with silver on the market, does that about alter Everton's thinking all of a sudden?
I would be amazed if Everton if Everton moved him out now. So obviously,
I'm not suggesting there was. Silver's available.
But it's, it's one of those awkward moments when you realise you've double booked to something and you've got to make the choice. And so, and Everton, the irony is obviously history now says Watford should have taken the money and moved him on, and everyone's happy.
Yeah, because they could have got millions in compensation, and now they're going to pay
it out. Everton, as you said, they've got an imbalanced squad. Everyone knew Lukaku was going, as he said. And there was lots of options, and like, who knows what Leicester City's resolve would have been, like Jamie Vardy, someone like that, someone like an old school finisher, sort of like, who will run the channels and do that work for you. Like, maybe not, hasn't got the physical presence of it, but there's options out there.
Yeah.
But they seem to have decided that Wayne Rooney, man, decided who wants to become a midfielder was the way to go initially. And yeah, it's a bit of a mess. Like, and in a way, I think it would say it's more about having had a go at the standard of the Premier League outside the top six earlier. I think it would actually sum it up if Everton got 8th or 7th this season, just because of how ordinary they actually are.
Yeah, I agree, mate. I agree. Okay, well, that is all we have time for. Thank you very much for joining us, Greg.
Cheers, Steve.
You can download the Extra Time podcast on iTunes or follow us on the website at thenational.ae/sport. And also be sure to follow us on Twitter at NatSportUAE.